We were on the last stages of building Communication Satellite 2. All the main units had been joined together, the living quarters had been pressurized, and the station had been given the slow spin around its axis that had restored the unfamiliar sensation of weight. I say slow, but at its rim our 200-foot diameter wheel was turning at 30 miles an hour. We had, of course, no sense of motion, but the centrifugal force caused by this spin gave us about half the weight we would have possessed on Earth. That was enough to stop things from drifting around, yet not enough to make us feel uncomfortably sluggish after our weeks with no weight at all. Four of us were sleeping in the small cylindrical cabin known as Bunkhouse Number 6 on the night that it happened. The bunkhouse was at the very rim of the station. If you imagine a bicycle wheel with a string of sausages replacing the tire, you have a good idea of the layout. Bunkhouse Number 6 was one of these sausages, and we were slumbering peacefully inside it. I was awakened by a sudden jolt that was not violent enough to cause me alarm, but which did make me sit up and wonder what had happened. Anything unusual in a space station demands instant attention, so I reached for the intercom switch by my bed. "Hello, Central," I called. "What was that?" There was no reply. The line was dead. Now thoroughly alarmed, I jumped out of bed and had an even bigger shock. There was no gravity. I shot up to the ceiling before I was able to grab a stanchion and bring myself to a halt at the cost of a sprained wrist. It was impossible for the entire station to have suddenly stopped rotating. There was only one answer. The failure of the intercom and, as I quickly discovered, of the lighting circuit as well, forced us to face the appalling truth. We were no longer part of the station. Our little cabin had somehow come adrift and had been slung off into space like a raindrop falling on a spinning flywheel. There were no windows through which we could look out, but we were not in complete darkness, for the battery-powered emergency lights had come on. All the main air vents had closed automatically when the pressure dropped. For the time being, we could live on our own private atmosphere, even though it was not being renewed. Unfortunately, a steady whistling told us that the air we did have was escaping through a leak somewhere in the cabin. There was no way of telling what had happened to the rest of the station. For all we knew, the whole structure might have come to pieces, and all our colleagues might be dead or in the same predicament as we, drifting through space in leaking cans of air. Our one slim hope was the possibility that we were the only castaways, that the rest of the station was intact and had been able to send a rescue team to find us. After all, we were receding at no more than 30 miles an hour, and one of the rocket scooters could catch up to us in minutes. It actually took an hour, though without the evidence of my watch, I should never have believed that it was so short a time. We were now gasping for breath, and the gauge on our single emergency oxygen tank had dropped to one division above zero. The banging on the wall seemed like a signal from another world. We banged back vigorously, and a moment later a muffled voice called to us through the wall. Someone outside was lying with his spacesuit helmet pressed against the metal, and his shouted words were reaching us by direct conduction. Not as clear as radio, but it worked. The oxygen gauge crept slowly down to zero while we had our council of war. We would be dead before we could be towed back to the station. Yet the rescue ship was only a few feet away from us, with its airlock already open. Our little problem was to cross that few feet without spacesuits. We made our plans carefully, rehearsing our actions in the full knowledge that there could be no repeat performance. Then we each took a deep, final swig of oxygen, flushing out our lungs. When we were all ready, I banged on the wall to give the signal to our friends waiting outside. There was a series of short staccato raps as the power tools got to work on the thin hull. We clung tightly to the stanchions, as far away as possible from the point of entry, knowing just what would happen. When it came, it was so sudden that the mind couldn't record the sequence of events. The cabin seemed to explode, and a great wind tugged at me. The last trace of air gushed from my lungs through my already opened mouth, and then utter silence, and the stars shining through the gaping hole that led to life. Believe me, I didn't stop to analyze my sensations. I think, though I can never be sure that it wasn't imagination, that my eyes were smarting, and there was a tingling feeling all over my body, and I felt very cold, perhaps because evaporation was already starting from my skin. The only thing I can be certain of is that uncanny silence. It is never completely quiet in a space station, for there is always the sound of machinery or air pumps. But this was the absolute silence of the empty void, where there is no trace of air to carry sound. Almost at once, we launched ourselves out through the shattered wall into the full blast of the sun. I was instantly blinded, but that didn't matter because the men waiting in spacesuits grabbed me as soon as I emerged and hustled me into the airlock. And there, sound slowly returned as the air rushed in, and we remembered we could breathe again. The entire rescue, they told us later, had lasted just 20 seconds. Well, we were the founding members of the Vacuum Breathers Club. Since then, at least a dozen other men have done the same thing in similar emergencies. The record time in space is now 2 minutes. After that, the blood begins to form bubbles as it boils at body temperature, and those bubbles soon get to the heart. In my case, there was only one after effect. For maybe a quarter of a minute, I had been exposed to real sunlight, not the feeble stuff that filters down through the atmosphere of Earth. Breathing space didn't hurt me at all, but I got the worst dose of sunburn I've ever had in my life. Freedom of space. Not many of you, I suppose, can imagine the time before the satellite relays gave us our present world communication system. When I was a boy, it was impossible to send TV programs across the oceans or even to establish reliable radio contact around the curve of the Earth without picking up a fine assortment of crackles and bangs on the way. Yet now we take interference-free circuits for granted and think nothing of seeing our friends on the other side of the globe as clearly as if we were standing face to face. Indeed, it's a simple fact that without the satellite relays, the whole structure of world commerce and industry would collapse. Unless we were up here on the space stations to bounce their messages around the globe, how do you think any of the world's big business organizations could keep their widely scattered electronic brains in touch with each other? But all this was still in the future, back in the late 70s, when we were finishing work on the relay chain. I've already told you about some of our problems and near disasters. They were serious enough at the time, but in the end we overcame them all. The three stations spaced around Earth were no longer piles of girders, air cylinders, and plastic pressure chambers. Their assembly had been completed. We had moved aboard and could now work in comfort, unhampered by spacesuits. And we had gravity again, now that the stations had been set slowly spinning. Not real gravity, of course, but centrifugal force feels exactly the same when you're out in space. It was pleasant being able to pour drinks and to sit down without drifting away on the first air current.